Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. As always, stick around for a rundown of the latest news here in the Chicago area at the end of the episode. But first, buying a home has become increasingly out of reach for too many Americans. And this week, members of Congress took a giant step to change that. They passed a bipartisan housing reform package that would restrict investors from buying up single-family homes, cut some of the red tape for new construction, and expand affordable housing. But then President Trump stepped in and gave an ultimatum, saying he wouldn't sign the bill unless Congress also passed new restrictions on voter ID and mail-in voting. So is this glimmer of affordable housing hope gone? Let's dig into it. At the table, Bob Palmer, Policy Director for Housing Action Illinois, Jeff Smith, who's Executive Director of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University, and Allison Clements, who's Executive Director of the Illinois Housing Council. I started with getting my panel's reaction to Trump's roadblock. Bob went first.
Well, obviously, we hope he changes his mind and signs it and Congress appeals to him because this is a very important bill. There's over 40 different provisions in it that support affordable housing in various ways. So We hope it gets signed.
Yeah. Jeff?
Agreed. I mean, I think it addresses one of the core challenges of the current housing crisis, which is the need to build more housing. So I think it's an important bill that hopefully moves forward.
What came to mind when you heard that, Allison?
We know there's a lot of bipartisan support for housing. This was really a huge victory that Congress passed this housing reform bill. And so, like Bob and Jeff said, we're hopeful that it will move forward.
Yeah. So let's dig into it. So the New York Times reported it's the first time in more than 30 years that Congress has done something like this, right? Passed a major legislative package that could make housing actually more affordable. So, Bob, can you break down what the 21st Century Road to Housing Act actually calls for?
I will do my best. Again, there's 40 provisions, more than that, so I won't try and summarize them all. But I think broadly, it has various provisions to increase housing supply and through incentives and pilot programs get local governments to do more, to give more tools to affordable housing developers that I'm sure Allison can talk about. It includes provisions on like manufactured housing, also appraisals, allowing homeowners and buyers to appeal appraisals if they don't agree with them, and many other provisions. But the focus is on increasing housing supply and affordability.
Sure. How historic would you say that this is?
You know, I have mixed feelings about it, and obviously we'll see how it gets implemented. It is a lot of pilot programs, a lot of things that are subject to appropriation, a lot of things that are subject to how the Trump administration implements them. I think obviously the bar for Congress accomplishing anything these days is very low. So just the fact that there was bipartisan support and the House and Senate working together is a major accomplishment. And again, shows that there's really increased public awareness that housing affordability, both for owners and renters and people experiencing homelessness, is really at unprecedented negative levels.
Yeah. Jeff and Allison, I want to hear from you. I mean, is the passing of this legislation, you think, a move in the right direction? And tell me if, sort of like Bob alluded to there, if this bill might have you concerned about some things. Allison?
I think it's a move in the right direction. We know it's going to reduce the barriers that exist for development in local communities, both on the market rate side, but also on the subsidized affordable housing side. One of the biggest provisions in the bill was raising what's called the public welfare investment cap. This is the threshold that exists for banks for which they can invest in specific affordable housing programs like the low-income housing tax credit program, which is really the most important tool we have to develop affordable rental housing. Raising this cap will allow for more private capital to invest in affordable housing development. So this is really an important victory. There's also some changes that will reduce sort of administrative barriers to participating in subsidized housing programs as well that will help.
Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, I think the core of the current housing crisis really goes back 15 years to the Great Recession, where we really stopped building housing. And even once housing development picked up, in 2012, it didn't really meet the growing demand for housing and the changing nature of demand, you know, types of households, income of households. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the crux of the current crisis, is that mismatch between demand and supply. And so I think the bill addresses the production of more housing, the production of more types of housing, the production of cheaper housing. So I think, you know, in spiritually at least, it addresses a lot of those key challenges.
Mm-hmm. An interesting part of the bill, too, aims to restrict large investors from buying up single-family homes. How big of an issue is that right now in our area, Bob?
It's a bit hard to track because there's like limited data availability. My understanding is it's not as big an issue in Illinois and the Chicago area as it is in some other states like Texas and Florida and so forth. But certainly in the aftermath of the Great Recession, there were a lot of investors who bought homes that had been foreclosed on, and many of them still own those homes and then are renting them out. Those specific provisions were subject to a lot of negotiation at the end. And okay. So there are a lot of changes made. I think people are still trying to understand.
Is it impacting local residents?
Will the bill itself impact local residents, or the issue of
this issue of investors buying up those homes?
Well, certainly the fact that a lot of single family homes are investor owned, it means that if they're owned that way, that means they're pretty much rental housing and they're not being offered for sale. So it's contributing very much so to the limited supply of more affordable homeownership opportunities.
Yeah, and keeping more people away from being able to be a homeowner for the first time in a lot of cases. Were you surprised, Allison, with how quickly the legislation passed? Because, I mean, it passed the Senate, I think, Monday, and then the House on Tuesday. It just seemed to move rather quickly.
I wasn't surprised. I think there's been many advocacy groups at the national level working with Congress on many of the individual components of the bill over the last several months. And so, you know, I think it is really a testament to how much of a challenge housing is in local communities. And I think the elected officials on both sides of the aisle are hearing from their constituents that they want them to do something on affordability and on housing access. So I think that's why we saw such swift movement and bipartisan support for the program.
Yeah. What does that bipartisan effort signal to you? The fact that, you know, many people were on the same page.
I think that, like I said, housing is a huge challenge for Americans across many different income scales, different communities, urban, suburban, rural. There simply isn't enough housing available for residents. And so I think Congress knew it had to act on this to offer viable solutions.
Yeah. And it's not just the housing stock or the supply, as you were talking about earlier, Jeff, but many people are feeling the effects of the fact that it's expensive, right? There are rising costs in housing and rents. So tell us more about what we're actually seeing on the ground when it comes to the cost of housing here in Chicago and Illinois.
Well, I think, you know, just to build on Allison's point, I think one of the key components of this current housing crisis is that it's increasingly affecting, you know, middle-income households. Like previously, when you talk about affordable housing, it's, you know, very low-income renters who need subsidy to support, you know, their access to housing. And that's maybe more of a niche issue for cities or for rural areas, but this issue really kind of has been broadened to affect middle-income potential home buyers, first-time home buyers, middle-income renters. And so I think that's really where the bipartisan nature of this bill kind of comes from, is that it's the current crisis is affecting all sorts of folks.
Yeah. How bad is the housing shortage here?
I mean, you know, I think that we, you know, calculate a number, you know, looking at sort of the mismatch between supply of and demand for, you know, affordable rental housing. And so we look at that metric and it's growing. I mean, I think the pandemic especially has accelerated this sort of mismatch and exacerbated this mismatch. And so, and it's really a supply issue, meaning we're losing lower cost rental housing, lower cost housing options in general. So in Chicago and in the region, I think that this is clearly addressing a big challenge.
Anything to add, Bob, about the housing shortage in our area?
Well, obviously, the greatest housing shortage is among people with the lowest incomes, the extremely low-income renters, and people experiencing homelessness. And unfortunately, the bill that just passed, that is a great bill, doesn't do a whole lot for that. And so I think we should be very excited about this bill that passed, but it doesn't eliminate the need to, like, oppose the cuts that the Trump administration is trying to make to the HUD budget or look to the state budget and state programs that can better serve the needs of those extremely low-income renters and people experiencing homelessness.
Yeah, I mean, and to that end, the aim of this bill is to make housing more affordable, as we've been talking about. But so we're all sort of level set here. And for folks listening, what does affordability actually mean? What are we talking about when we say that? Affordable to whom? What does that look like?
Generally, it's for anyone. You shouldn't be spending more than 30% of your income on housing costs. You know, when we talk about some of the programs targeted at lower income renters, like Bob is mentioning, government subsidy programs generally have targeted 60% of the area median income, which for a family of four in the Chicago area is just under $70,000. Mm-hmm. So those are the types of income targets that subsidized programs are often looking at.
And Allison, what do you make of the proposed changes to restrictions on construction, including zoning, and how that might impact developers?
Sure. I think, like Bob said, there's incentive programs, pilot programs, guidance that will be issued by HUD on best practices at zoning reform. Anything that communities can do to make it easier to build housing locally will have an impact. So I think it's important that there are these provisions. At the same time, I would echo Bob's points that we still need the funding programs that come through HUD to subsidize the cost of construction to be offering affordable housing to our lowest income renters, because we know that that's where the biggest need is.
Now, there's a quote here. Housing Financial Committee Services Chair French Hill of Arkansas said, housing affordability starts with supply, right? We've been talking about this. Is that the bottom line here? Is building more housing really the best way for us to reduce cost, Bob?
I think so. We need subsidies for people with the lowest incomes, but the biggest thing that limits people's housing choices about where they live, where they can live and what they can afford is the lack of supply. And that's where I think our public policy at all levels of government comes up the most short in terms of really figuring out ways to encourage and require more housing supplies. So I think that quote is exactly on target.
Yeah. Jeff, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I definitely think, you know, at least at the in the current situation, the supply side is really what's driving the affordability crisis. And I think it's a product of, you know, A, not building enough, but also B, not building enough types of housing to accommodate the changing demand that we're seeing. We have got smaller households, we've got older households, we've got you know, folks who maybe need more space or less space. I mean, I think that the flexibility, I think, that to build different types of housing is really important. I think, you know, changing zoning, changing building codes, et cetera, mm-hmm. I think will allow for developers in the private market to respond to that emerging kind of evolving demand side.
Yeah. Tell us more, Allison, about, you know, maybe what's not working right now. I know that when you had a conversation with a producer here, you talked about this Build America, Buy America concept. So walk us through that. What exactly does that mean for folks who may not know? And walk me through your thinking there.
Sure. This is a provision that was actually implemented under the infrastructure bill that passed under President Biden. And it requires for specific federal funding programs, including at HUD, that all materials that are used on an affordable housing development using that funding source have to be produced and sourced in the United States. Mm-hmm. This has become a really big challenge for affordable housing providers. It's adding costs to the production of affordable housing. I was speaking with a nonprofit developer earlier this week, and they noted it added $600,000 to the cost of their one of their developments.
Ooh, okay.
Some products can't be found in the United States, so they've had to request waivers. It can take up to 6 months to get that waiver. So what's in this bill is a direction for HUD to actually evaluate the impact of this program, and we're hoping issue some new guidance that will provide some relief from some of the burden that this new requirement is adding on to affordable housing.
Interesting. So I know we talked earlier about President Trump and his, you know, sort of ultimatum there about not signing this bill into law. Now, just digging into that, it looks like, you know, if he doesn't sign it within the next 10 days or so, while Congress is still in session, it would still become law. And though Congress does have the power to override any kind of presidential veto. So let's say that this does, you know, continue to move forward. And as we're still sort of in the excitement of the passage and the possibilities, how soon could we see it take effect, Jeff?
Well, I think if you're talking about the effects of it, I mean, I think it's going to take some time because, you know, if you're talking about building new housing, you've got sort of, there needs to be time for the rules to be kind of taken effect by, you know, and local governments really do change their policies. Then you need to sort of get the housing production pipeline started, and then you have to deliver those products essentially to the market. So that can take time, and therefore, then that has to then affect the market too. So I don't know that for the supply side, you know, you're going to see an immediate effect, but I do think that over the longer term, it will certainly reduce the cost of housing.
Sure. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker tried to push forward that build plan of his. That's the Building Up Illinois Developments Plan. It never made it onto either the House or Senate floor, unfortunately. Is Illinois actually prepared to build more affordable housing, Bob? What do you say?
Well, I think the answer is yes, but there are a lot of local government obstacles, and at Housing Action Illinois, we continue to support the build plan because it actually would actually build on the good things that the federal government is doing,
right,
and provides a good balance between more state oversight and guidelines and local control. But we know it is very controversial. There was a lot of opposition, and we want to keep supporting the governor's office as they have conversations with the General Assembly about how to pass something maybe later this year.
Yeah, and one such thing in the works, Illinois State Treasurer Michael Frerichs announced this week, actually, a new community investment program. It's going to, or designed to help build more affordable housing. He invested $10 million into the initiative. And to me, it sounds like, to your point, there's some sort of statewide movement here to fix this problem, right?
The signs demonstrate so, but obviously we need to work hard to make sure it all comes to fruition.
So, I mean, as we start to wrap here, I'd love to hear from you all. Like, what's next here, you know, for the person trying to follow along with this bouncing ball and also just, you know, struggling to figure out what they're going to do when it comes to their housing situation? What are you keeping an eye on, Allison?
I think we'll continue to see, you know, where the General Assembly goes in Illinois. You know, the build plan was left unresolved, and we know that there is an interest among state lawmakers to do something on housing. So we'll be continuing at the Illinois Housing Council to support that initiative, as well as both state and federal investments in the capital that's needed to build affordable housing too, since we know that that's important.
Sure. What's on your radar, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Road to Housing Act, the Build Act, these, you know, indicators that housing is a really important thing for consumers these days, but, you know, they don't address still some of the challenges that have been mentioned earlier, that affordability for really low-income renter households, there are also just ongoing affordability pressures for homeowners related to property taxes, related to insurance costs. So these are things that, you know, are not part of these current supply-side policies, but still need to be considered.
Yeah, and Bob?
Well, I would say for this good federal legislation that just passed, I think really we'll have to look like 3 or 4 years from now to see kind of what the impact has been. You know, in the meantime, we're continuing to be very focused on next year's federal budget and making sure there's the increases we need for housing choice vouchers and public housing and homeless assistance and all the other programs.
We'll leave it there for now. Bob Palmer is Policy Director with Housing Action Illinois. Jeff Smith is Executive Director with the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University, and Allison Clements, Executive Director of the Illinois Housing Council. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to the biggest stories in Chicago and the country. New York City bagels are coming to Chicago. There are new efforts to combat violence on the CTA, plus more storms and at least one tornado. Summer Van Benton, WBEZ reporter, and Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, joined me to break things down. And Claire kicked it off with a weather report. Here she is.
Last evening's storms left many suburban residents with kind of severe damage. Not so much here in city limits, but media reporting this morning, and we've been seeing it on the TV news, residents in the northwestern burbs had downed trees, power lines, some of these trees fully uprooted, falling on people's homes and cars.
Jeez.
National Weather Service says it was notable straight line wind damage near Streamwood, Bartlett, Hanover Park, and also yet again in Northwest Indiana, Merrillville and Griffith, Indiana.
So I can only imagine how things looked out there this morning.
Well, there was also a tornado, at least one confirmed near Huntley, a video showing debris just getting lofted immediately and very quickly into the air.
Wow.
So, yeah, more picking up the pieces for some, even while many are still picking up the pieces right from previous storms. And so it goes.
And now on the other side of the world, Western Europe is in the grips of a record-breaking heat wave. But it looks like we could also see that as well next week.
Well, we should say France shattered its all-time heat record yet again. Today, and that heat wave continues. People swimming in the Seine yet again as a way to beat the heat. But yeah, mm-hmm. we're going to be dealing with this here. So not this weekend, but thinking Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Some from sweltering
the 70s today, we are going to be up into the 90s.
Ooh, all right. Yesterday, Summer, you were busy. You attended a public hearing mm-hmm. at City Hall. This was about teen gatherings. Who was there?
There were a lot of officials there, a lot of elder people there, and a lot of youth organizations brought youth to the room, which is powerful considering, you know, a lot of youth don't come to town halls and public hearings at City Hall. So I'm proud of them for bringing you to the table.
You never really get to hear their voices, yeah. right? Or hardly, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So here's one of those young people, Ramaya Simone. She's a youth leader at a group called Communities United.
Mm-hmm.
She was there at yesterday's hearing. I want to play a little bit of what she told WBEZ's Mariah Wolfel.
There is no such thing as good or bad kids because we are just kids. And so when I say we are a reflection of our city, that means that the kids of our city is that we get what the city pour into us. So if the city is pouring into guns and disinvestments, then that's what we're going to represent.
Yeah, so she says, you know, we're getting a bad rap.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of conversation lately about these teen trends or teen takeovers.
Mm-hmm.
You talked with some of the young people. Does that sound sort of like what they were telling you, or tell me what was on their mind?
Definitely. It feels like there is a huge communication gap between our youth and adults, and that space was a lot of communication and idea sharing. A lot of the youth and adults alike talked about their visions for the city. They talked about some of the gaps that the city may have and how they can fill those gaps, but also addressing a lot of the misconceptions as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's just also a lot of policing going on.
Right.
You know, that's been the response. Let's crack down. Let's limit what they can
yes.
do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think history has shown that youth aren't super responsive to that.
Yeah. We're not dealing with a new problem here. We have seen this kind of teen gathering trend evolve over time. And I think that was one major point from yesterday's conversation is that, you know, it's not new for teens to gather, but what is an ever-going issue is this policing of particularly Black and Latino groups.
Mm. Well, and when you know, the evolution of this, we were talking about this on your show, when malls are closing left mm-hmm. and right, when you have, you know, park space that isn't as accessible mm-hmm. on the south and
right.
west sides, things like that, what are the youth to do, but where are the youth to go?
Aren't as many jobs, where are they to go?
Exactly. Yeah. What are the alternatives?
Yeah, and they're gravitating towards safe spaces, honestly. Our park districts should be safe spaces. Our beaches should be safe spaces. You know, and one thing that I really appreciated is that one of the sources I spoke to said, you know, what isn't caught on camera? We're grilling, we're playing music, we're dancing, we're having fun, we're sharing art. But normally that photo that you see online is usually the one time that something bad pops off.
Mm. You're attending another teen gathering town hall today.
Yes.
Who are the planned speakers for this one?
So they too plan on bringing some youth to the table, youth who organize some of these teen gatherings, some that attend, but there will also be some officials there as well, continuing the conversation.
Yeah. Claire, in other news, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, he's leading a new effort to address violence on the CTA. What exactly is the plan there?
So the current system for policing on trains and buses is a system between Metro Police, right, for Metro trains, Chicago Police across CTA, and a variety of suburban police departments when it comes to PACE. So Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart is leading a new task force that he thinks is going to patrol and police just a bit more successful. Usually Dart's office is running the jail, right,
mm-hmm.
as we know, and often in the suburbs, but the Sun-Times report reporting that this force was created under, as we know, the newly enacted sweeping transit law. And after making hundreds of arrests and issuing thousands of warnings in the last 2.5 months, DART's office is sort of using this transit task force as a means to decide if that's going to work, if this could be a viable alternative to patrol CTA, MACE, PACE, and Metro as sort of that trifecta. So this would be, you know, a new version of this would be one of the largest changes to how transit operates, period, in the city.
I'm encouraged by just the different levels of government trying to pour into this issue.
100%.
Right?
And DART, you know, is being seemingly realistic about this, that more work needs to be done, that there's going to be trial and error. And he did say the new system will not look how it looks now. So there is going to be some unification across the three transit systems.
Interesting. Now, you know that we all love and appreciate the beauty of summertime shy, but air pollution in the city also tends to ramp up at this time of year. WBEZ's Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has a story this week. It was about a new device that can keep tabs on the city's air quality. How does it work, Claire?
So this is a network of 277 air monitors that are now keeping tabs on Chicago's air quality throughout the year, especially during the summer when, you know, as you mentioned, it's much worse for residents. But what's unique about this is that it can monitor, and it will be monitoring air quality neighborhood to neighborhood. So you're not just going to have that, you know, that banner when you wake up in the morning, the air quality for all of Chicago is this. But what the system is trying to do is compartmentalize that data and make it sort of hyper-local.
How do they plan on using the data?
So this is a partnership between the University of Chicago and the city's public health department. But essentially, they're designed to collect the local air data that's showing real-time pollution figures. And then they're going to give those figures, give that data to officials to help develop different guidance, specific guidance for things like permitting, urban planning, and most importantly, air quality control from hood to hood.
Okay.
Really interesting.
Summer, famous New York City bagel chain H&H Bagels is opening its first Chicago store tomorrow.
Let's get it.
Why is that such a big deal for folks?
It's a big deal because who doesn't love a good bagel?
The bagels are really good.
Oh my gosh, the bagels are delicious. And it's hard to talk about the story as I haven't had breakfast yet. But no, it's opening in Fulton Market and we're super excited to see it hit the town. There's actually been a lot of bagel shops opening across the city.
The bagel wars, some might say.
Yeah.
We've been seeing this in the Wicker Park neighborhood, you know, some of those big chains versus the mom and
Chicago,
pop stuff.
Is Chicago about to start being known for bagels?
we're trying to be.
Move over, yeah. Italian beef.
That would make the New Jerseyans really upset. I don't know.
Do you have a favorite bagel spot, Claire?
That's a really good question. I like the throwback to my roots. I like the onion roll. This is on North Avenue. Wow. This is technically in Oak Park.
Okay, okay. Well, while I got you in the hot seat, tell me what else you're watching today.
Yes, Courtney Kippers has a wonderful audio narrative this morning on our website, WBEZ.org. Also pictures, but FX's hit comedy set Kitchen Dramedy. We love it. The Bear.
The Bear is back.
It is back, and then it will be gone. It is wrapping its fifth and final season, but it premieres tonight. So as we know, the show follows the group of chefs, also family drama, transforming an Italian beef stand into a very high-end restaurant. But what Courtney was looking at is the show really put Chicago's food scene, even, you know, places like Mr. Beef that have been around for years, on the map.
Sure does.
And there are tours now to a lot of these places. And she sort of takes us on a tour. But the episodes, the final 8 episodes available to stream on Hulu tonight at 8 o'clock. So get your beef before you tune in.
We have to hang the Bear in the metaphorical raptors of Chicago.
You absolutely
media.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Iconic series. And what are you keeping an eye on, Summer?
So much. So as you mentioned earlier, I'll be attending a teen gathering. Yeah, it is.
A teen town hall.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love alliteration. I also, you know, Pride Fest was this past weekend. There is a Pride parade this upcoming weekend. And then also, I talked about it before, but a group of Westsiders are helping to memorialize and archive West Side history. And so they're having a showcase this Saturday, which is really exciting.
You're a busy, busy gal.
Hey, keeps
That's
the plot hot.
WBEZ's Summer Van Benton and Claire Lane.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yason, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/intheloop. Thanks for listening.